You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, February 5th, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday, folks. I've got my soft-collared shirt on and my Zumbas. On the program today, as we have every Friday, when we're lucky, Cliff Schechter, to look back on the week that was, and what a week it was. Multiple Democratic debates, charges of cheating on the Republican side. Also on the program today, to offer some counter-programming for the big game. Oh, incidentally, we should put on our website the time of the, can we say it, superb owl on this? Put it on the website. That's the oldest hit-generating clickbait trick in the book. Matthew Film Guy will be here. For those of you who don't want to watch the Super Bowl, what can you watch during that time? Well, Matthew Film Guy will give you a film recommendation on the program today. Yes, the Democratic debate last night, the first head-to-head debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. We have a New Hampshire primary coming up in 2 days, 3 days. 3 days? 4 days. Also on the program, a look at Bernie Sanders' foreign policy. Does he have one? Does it matter? Clinton heading to Flint, Michigan, where new revelations show that Governor Snyder's administration knew of a spike in Legionnaire disease 9 months before they told the public. Meanwhile, President Obama proposes a $10 per barrel tax on oil. And poor Jeb Bush has become a national, really, I mean, pity case, pity project for the country. It's like every day is like an after-school special for Jeb Bush. Honestly, this is biopic material we're headed into. He's falling apart.
Boring biopic.
No, I think it's a fascinating story of what happened to, you know, an American family.
American blue blood power psychosexual implosion.
It's like the what was that called? I can't remember now. There was a big miniseries back in the 70s and 80s. It was all about miniseries. It was like something Dove. It was like a big book with like a priest who then leaves the priesthood and gets, I can't remember. I don't remember what it was. But this is, I feel like Thornbirds or something like that. Do you even guys know what I'm talking about? This was so big. Have you ever heard of Roots?
I've heard of it.
Yeah. When I was in the 70s, like they discovered the miniseries. So it was like the Thornbirds and Roots and the Holocaust.
Dude.
It was a mini series.
Slavery was totally not acceptable. Like, I had no idea until I saw LeVar Burton.
That's right.
It's crazy.
Completely wrong. That is one thing that we're contemplating. I don't know if we should talk about this, but we should probably raise it because I'm vacillating.
Your views on the Roots?
No. So here's the plan, folks. I'm going to go up to New Hampshire on Monday and Tuesday. On Monday, I'm going to do some pre-tapes. I got to be honest with you. I said yes to this a while back. I have been doing nothing but regretting it since that time that I agreed to do this. They have Radio Rows, and you know, I'm not saying I was doing somebody a favor, but you know, I just wasn't terribly. I don't know. I'm regretting it. I don't want to go up to New Hampshire. I'm not sure that it's going to be that interesting. And I look at the guests that I have. There's one or two guests that if we get them, I'll be happy. You know, at one point it looked like I was going to get Martin O'Malley. That would have been interesting just to talk to a guy who's clearly not going to win the next day and see if he was going to go, you know, if there was a chance that he would go Bullworth or even like, you know, partly Bullworth.
Yeah, I will.
No, he's not.
Drunk O'Malley.
He's not even going to show up. He's obviously not going to be there. There's a couple of people I may be able to get while I'm up there, or may not. And you know, if I can sit down with a couple of journalists, like maybe like a guy like Dave Weigel or Taibbi may be up there, people who've been on the campaign trail, that might be interesting. But I don't know if I'm going to get those guys because they're going to be going out and doing reporting. So the point is that, you know, I'll be live from there on Tuesday. I'm going to call in Monday. Michael has a very good guest on Monday, but I'm going to call in towards the end of the show and just give a report. It probably be just a series of complaints.
Like, hey, Sam, how's it going up there?
And I'll be like, it sucks. It's not good. I'm not doing anything. Yeah. I'm sitting in the Radisson Hotel. There's no good food here. I'm just in, you know, a Radio Row. I don't know why I did this.
Any worthwhile conversations or insight you're getting?
No, none.
Right.
Absolutely none. I've been up here before. I knew what to expect. I don't know why I came. There, you don't even have to listen to my interview on Monday.
There it is.
When I'm going to call in. So then my plan is to drive back after the show on Tuesday. It's going to be a 4.5-hour drive. And at that time, it's probably going to be like a 6-hour drive because of traffic. So hold on for one second. So it's probably going to be like a 6-hour drive as I come down from New Hampshire, pull into New York City. And then the kids are going to be like, what are you doing? How can you play with us? Blah, blah, blah. And then I've got to watch the returns. So then on Wednesday, obviously, we're going to do a recap of the returns. Here's the question. We've been contemplating... Now, how do I put this? I don't want to crush anybody's fantasies or notions, but on April Fool's and on Halloween Day, something happens to our stream where inevitably something goes wrong. Technically,
we haven't been able to figure it out.
We have not been able to figure it out.
Usually involves, in fact, both mats at this point, which is really bizarre.
It's very bizarre. It's really taken a couple of years to piece it together because every day after that day, either April Fool's or Halloween, we get emails saying like, hey, what happened yesterday? I got some type of right-wing show. Well, I have a little bit of a confession to make. That was actually us doing a fake version of a right-wing show. And we enjoy doing it so much, and it's such a vacation for us. Because we don't have to really actually do any rigorous research.
Which is the best part, clearly, of doing a right-wing show. We can literally show up like 20 minutes before and be like, hey,
right,
the government's taking over.
Right.
Black people.
It's easy.
Lesbians.
Right. It's easy.
Boom.
But people also seem to enjoy it. And so one thing we contemplated was doing the results of New Hampshire with that show. Because we're going to probably start doing it on a regular basis. Not necessarily... as part of this show, although probably on occasion as part of the show, but we're going to actually, I think, you know, I don't know. We may grow into something else. But so I've been debating as to whether or not we should do it that Wednesday. Just come in. You know, it's pretty straightforward information. The analysis works on both sides. I don't know. But if people want to give us feedback on that, do at majorityreporters@gmail.com. I don't even know why I brought that all that stuff up. But I did. So, folks, let me just remind you that this program relies on its members to exist. So here's the deal. If you can afford to support the free show, we give you a gift of an extra hour of, well, it's not really an hour, but it's usually it ends up being a little bit more than an hour, but we give you an extra 50 minutes, but we could call it the fun hour. It doesn't matter. We're not obligated. We're not signing a contract. Well, I guess we are signing a contract to you, but nevertheless, it's not a binding contract on us. It's only binding on you. If you want to become a member of the program.
Way to sell it.
I've got a lot of lawyers. Join themajorityreport.com. Our revenue comes almost exclusively from members. And also justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. But if you don't want to buy stuff from Amazon, you don't buy stuff from Amazon, and you want to buy it from a an up-and-coming competitor of Amazon, which has a very good track record, as far as I can tell, in the investigations I have done, in terms of their employees, Jet.com. Then you get 15% off right now, your first purchases, your first order at jet.com. You can sign up via majorityreporters@gmail.com. What am I talking about? Majorityreportkickback.com is where our Jet link is too. All right, quick break. We come back. Cliff Schechter. All right, folks, we're back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. That, of course, Maurice White, the lead singer of Earth, Wind, and Fire. Perhaps one of the most important bands to my young pre-adolescence. Or maybe even close into my adolescence. I have a feeling there was a couple of bar mitzvah parties or camp socials I went to where the reasons. All right, ladies and gentlemen, on the phone. I know that resonates with the next guy too, who's going to be on. Ladies and gentlemen, I will not sing this song, but it is crucial in introducing our regular Friday guest.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC, New Media, Public Relations, and Strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC.
Yes, Cliff Schechter. Was Earth, Wind, and Fire, were they an important band in your life when you were a kid? I gotta imagine growing up in New York City, Earth, Wind, and Fire for you around that time would have been pretty big.
Yeah, I definitely was a fan, no doubt. I mean, I there were a couple that were a little, Led Zeppelin was a little more.
Really?
My 15-year-old 80s, mid to late, I'm trying to think when Earth, Wind, and Fire were definitely big then, but when kind of their biggest albums came out. I mean, I definitely was a fan, let's put it that way. Not on the level of like a Led Zeppelin or, the Who, but I was a fan, absolutely.
Well, Cliff, you know that on this program, I don't like to in any way get a sense of people's personalities and dig in any way. But I've always presumed that you were like a very, like a sort of almost like a disco breakdancing kid, like in your adolescence.
Oh yeah, breakdance to Electric Boogaloo. That was me.
Honestly, were you or no? Because I had that bad image of you as being like a scrappy little breakdance, one of those breakdance kids at the time.
No? I wish. No, I was I'm thinking my like, you know, early to mid teens right now. So that's like mid to late 80s, right? I was a, long haired, you should see my hair from back then. There was some serious mullet action, although the front was kind of long too. Playing guitar, had my Fender Strat.
Wow.
Was in a band. We were trying to knock out, like, what did we play? Deep Purple, Smoke on the Water. Nice. I just have to think about a few others. We definitely played a little Zeppelin here and there. I was more of like the mixture of like classic rock to almost early metal.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Van Halen, some Metallica. Yeah, that was me, man.
I would not have guessed that. That's a little bit,
it's a little bit more than you wanted to know, isn't it?
No, it's exactly what I wanted to know. I mean, that's what I asked. I'm a little bit surprised. I've got some reevaluating to do. Now, Cliff.
Yeah, there was a good year in high school, like my sophomore year, I want to say. Maybe my junior year. I don't remember. I was 87, 88, somewhere in there, where if you were to name almost any classic rock band or early metal band, I saw them at like Madison Square Garden or Giant Stadium or every single one.
Wow. All right. I did not know that. I mean, it could go either way with the New York kid at that time. But I guess
you're right.
That's in Worcester. That's all there was. We didn't.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was that's it. There was nothing.
Oh, didn't you guys have New Kids on the Block? That was a little early for that. But you know, the Wahlberg,
New Kids on the Block. Actually, I got into when I was 15 or 16. I think it was. Well, that's when they came out. Well, we were doing a little
bit.
Right.
Of, I mean, that was Boston's reaction to grunge, right?
Yeah. Well, grunge was a little bit later. It was a little bit later. But, okay. All right. So, Cliff, now that we've got.
We've gotten that out of the way.
Let's get into this debate last night. Why don't you give me your general takeaways? And then we've got a bunch of sound we can go into. But this was the first, two person debate that we've seen in either party. It came together very late, I think with 24 hours notice. The people at MSNBC were very excited that it was happening. And just give me your hot take, as they call it.
I wouldn't call it a knockout for either side. It seemed to me it felt very much like late round, Rocky versus Drago kind of thing, you know? Each of them were just pounding on each other for at least, I didn't see the end of it. I got too tired, but I watched it for a while. And at least for the period of time I was watching it, they were going after each other. I thought in both cases, I think the end result of that close, the close election in Iowa means that they kind of realize that they're both in the game. And that I think has kind of raised the stakes a little bit. I think I think Sanders is being more positive, trying to catch up with Hillary. Hillary is sort of taking things for granted, not an unusual posture for her.
Right.
Now they're two heavyweights standing side by side. O'Malley's gone. There's no, they don't have that sort of third buffer on the stage. And I mean, that's the way I viewed it. I mean, did I see that? Can I remember anybody making any sort of huge kind of takedowns? I mean, there's no doubt that Hillary kind of saying, defending taking money and from Wall Street, but not having to do their bidding. I mean, look, there's no way she can defend. There'd be plenty of time in her life. I have no problem. We are a capitalist society, and I have no problem with her somewhere down the road where she had no influence anymore, going on the speaking circuit and all that. It's very hard for her to defend the fact that in between, being a Secretary of State and running for president, that she was taking these big amounts of money. And there's all sorts of ways that we all know this. I mean, human beings in by nature is if you're a part of a certain crowd, it's a lot harder to criticize that crowd.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the big problem with the media in Washington. They're not all terrible people, but when you're going out to cocktail parties and you're seeing people on Saturday night, it's kind of hard to rip into them on Sunday morning. Ted Cruz seems to have that ability, but many people don't.
That's right.
And so to me, that stuff's just not defensible. And that's where I think her weakest moment came. I think Bernie Sanders' weakest moment came. There was a period of time there in the beginning when they, or not in the beginning, one of the foreign policy questions
right.
they asked him about North Korea, you know, Iran, and
Russia.
Was it Russia? That's right. And his response was ISIS. And he really looked like he was kind of tripping over his words and, you know, said North Korea is a very unique. I mean, I hate to say this, and I'm not saying this to be nasty, but it almost sounded amateur, his answer about North Korea.
Right.
Because it really seemed to be like, well, they're kind of isolated and weird. It's a weird situation. That's not really the way you usually refer to a foreign policy situation. And so I thought that was his worst thing, was that he didn't really seem comfortable at all with foreign policy. As you know, but I don't think either of them knocked the other one out, not from my perspective. I think they each had sort of some weaknesses and they each had some strengths. I guess I think that's where I would leave it.
You know, Chris Matthews, and I generally don't find myself saying this. I mean, he's a very nice man. But he made a point that I thought was actually really, really accurate, which was that this debate, I think, may have helped Clinton a little bit in New Hampshire, but it probably helped Bernie Sanders nationally because, I mean, look, first of all, they both spoke for about, I haven't seen the minutes tallies, but I'd be surprised if they both spoke for less than 45 minutes each, maybe 35 minutes each. And that's like 3 to 4, 5 times what the Republicans talk, each individual talks
right.
in the context of the debate.
In a way, we're talking about, you know, O'Malley as a buffer. I'll just say it quickly. You know, some of these guys in the Republican stage, certainly Ted Cruz for a while benefited from having Donald Trump there, but lots of the other ones did too. They have a lot of buffers because you really, if you can get in your four main points and the media in the way they do, normally comes to you on the thing that you're, quote, known for or branded for, which is what you're going to know about, as opposed to coming to you in the things that you don't talk about, which is what they should be doing.
Right.
So, yeah, so this there's no doubt this is different than that, and that's good for us.
And you have the challenger, Sanders, showing that he can stay on stage with Hillary Clinton, who is, you know, in my mind, the debate format is her best format, I think, personally. I mean, because it seems inevitable to me that during the sort of the one-on-one things, she goes into areas where she you know makes a mistake here or there or whatnot. But let me what frustrates
me.
She's very
smart at ad-libbing, and I think you can be a little more doesn't you know come off as authentic. I think that's not a controversial thing for me to say, as he does. And I don't think that matters as much in a debate. I think you're right. In speeches, I think that is a little...
Right. I mean, I think she's just more keyed in when she's in sort of a more sort of contested environment, frankly. And, you know, I say this is someone who I think I'm that way as well, frankly. But...
I am too.
I think you and I share that same thing. Like, you know, we're going to be the most glib when we've got someone coming at us. And so, but
focuses
I think
the mind in an amazing way.
I think your assessment of the two points of weakness, their respective points of weakness, is accurate, and it's basically what I think most people are walking away with. But here's what I find really frustrating about Bernie Sanders' attack and about this whole speaking fees thing is that the speaking fees thing is a metaphor. And because they are focusing on it so much, now I understand why there's so much focus on the speaking fees, because it's the most digestible thing that you can articulate to a broad audience, right? I mean, it looks bad. It's sort of nebulous. But this whole thing with release the text of the speeches, my fear about this is that what is getting lost is what is really the issue. They don't pay Hillary Clinton, they don't pay Hillary Clinton to come and speak, and then she goes and does their bidding. The reason why they invite her in the first place is because she's the type of person who already does their bidding. Like, she does things, and it's not that she's doing their bidding. That's what she does. You know, I'm going to get invited, not to an organization that's going to say, like, hey, maybe if we invite Sam to speak and give him a speaking fee, he's going to say the things on his show that we want him to say. No, they invite me because I'm already saying those things, and I'm already doing those things.
Shockingly, you don't generally get invited to those sort of the Walmart investor meetings.
Right.
When the PNACs get together, you don't tend to show up at those. Yeah.
I think Bernie Sanders' attacks are missing the mark a little bit because this thing is just so easy and it's low hanging fruit. But here's the problem, right? What if she does release those texts of her speech, or what if she doesn't? Either way, it becomes problematic, because either it's like, you know, do we really anticipate that she's going to come up there and speak to the Goldman Sachs people and be like, hey, now that it's just you and I, and thanks to the 250 grand, like, well, I'm going to, you know, all right, crap on all the people.
Let's go.
I'm going to crap on the people and give you all the money. I mean, it's not going to be. That's not what's happening.
Come on, who's got the craziest derivative for me? Come on.
Right, honestly, and it's just because she is of that world, and
he got into that a little bit. I mean, I know he brought up Bob Rubin, for example.
Right.
You know, and he I don't think he expanded on that, and I think that, you know, you can do that and have that be legitimate without it being a character attack. So in some ways, I wish he would do more of that.
Yes.
Which is just to sort of be like, look, you know, this isn't that you're corrupt. This isn't that you're, you know, you they've changed your opinion. These are the people that you socialize with. This is who you're comfortable with. You know, who was your, you know, your husband's treasury? I mean, I guess it's tough to say your husband's whatever, but point out just sort
well,
of...
Well, I forget
the,
about
know,
husband's
the,
treasury.
The relationships.
Look, yeah. There's a piece by Ben Jacobs in The Guardian from... last July, okay? And two of her top aides at the State Department, Tom Nides and Robert Hormats, they have, Nides is described as a Clinton confidant, longtime Morgan Stanley executive, served as Deputy Secretary of State for Management Resources for 2 years before returning to Morgan Stanley, also the former chairman of the Securities Industry Financial Markets Association, that is the main lobbying group for Wall Street in Washington, D.C., okay? The Hormats is a former vice chair of Goldman Sachs, served as undersecretary for state for economic growth.
There you go, right.
Now, where is he?
Not mention her husband. And also, she's played a prominent role, obviously, in the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
And my guess is, if you look who's on that board, which I haven't bothered to do, but if you did, you'd have the same thing as you just pointed out.
Hormats is currently the vice chairman of Kissinger Associates, which is the consulting firm founded by Henry Kissinger. They both have a strong history of taking a pro-business stance on financial regulation. Hormats has been described as Clinton's economic guru, boasted of Clinton's State Department's support of the business community in 2013. He's also been supportive of partial privatization of Social Security, touted the benefits of wide-scale deregulation in the 90s.
And my guess is Erskine Bowles has to be involved in their lives still in some way.
Well, I mean, look,
right?
he
just has to be.
Right,
he's always everywhere.
But all these people come, in other words, she fishes, this is the pond she fishes in.
Right.
And they know it, and she knows it, and it's not nefarious. It's just, this is where she goes fishing.
And I think that's a legitimate criticism, and I think you're right. It'd be better because he's trying to make it look like a little bit of sort of penny ante corruption. Like,
I'm not saying
675 is nothing, but it's nothing compared to the vast amount of time that she spends with these people and who she's around. And I think that that's the better criticism. Is that, look, it's not, this is just your worldview. This is who you're comfortable with. And frankly, it's not a quid pro quo in that, like, there's not one thing that comes up. There's things that come up all the time.
Look,
that affect Wall Street and all sorts of bills. And that's the argument. He should be making a broader argument is what he should be doing.
There are ex-senators who get speaking fees. But you just don't get invited. Bernie Sanders, when he's an ex-senator, is not going to get invited to certain places because he is not of their ilk. She is of their ilk. And
I mean, how many pictures must be out there of the Clintons with major figures at Clinton Foundation things, at, you know, at other functions with, you know, of them with, you know, the person, rich person A and CEO B. And I mean, you'd think that this really actually wouldn't be that difficult a thing to do without being really nasty about it. So in a way, I agree with you. I think he's failing in what he's doing because he's making it more about a corruption
yes,
in terms of like quid pro quo corruption, which it really isn't.
No.
And he's also, you know, and so and he's not doing so. He's sort of, it comes off as a nastier personal attack, which I do think it does, as you know, and then it also, he fails in actually really kind of making this as broad a narrative as it should be.
It's not a question of her integrity. Yeah. It's a question of her pedigree. And she is actually, there's plenty of integrity there. I have no doubt that if one of these guys, you know, broke the law that she, or I should say, you know, committed a, let me rephrase it. If they did something, you know, if they were involved in a hit and run, she would say they should be arrested. or, you know, if they, but I think the idea is that her perception of what role finance plays is has been developed and is been awash. And here is also where Bernie Sanders failed last night. When she wanted and challenged him for an example of how money and how these donors have corrupted Clinton or have a corrupting power, what he should have referred to was to the 2002, I believe it was,
bankruptcy bill.
Now, yep. Here is Elizabeth Warren. And we know this story because Elizabeth Warren was telling this story in 2004. Maybe she told it before then. But this is a video of Elizabeth Warren when she was simply a law professor at Harvard, had been writing at probably in 2004. She's writing on Josh Marshall's blog at TPM about the bankruptcy bill. And she's telling the story about how she had written about the bankruptcy bill. This bill had been kicking around in the 90s. It basically did not allow your average person the same rights under bankruptcy as corporations have. And she writes a paper about it. She gets a call from Hillary Clinton out of the blue, who was then first lady, and says, I want to talk to you about this bankruptcy bill. She meets with her in Boston. They have lunch together in a small room in a hotel. Elizabeth Warren is telling Bill Moyers in this instance the story of how she lays it out to Hillary Clinton. She said she never had a better student. Hillary Clinton immediately got it, not only got the dynamics of the bill, but then was able to sort of say, oh, well, this is going to mean this. This is going to mean that. This was a bill that was headed towards being signed because it was going to be passed by the Republican Senate and Congress. And apparently, according to Elizabeth Warren, she heard that when Hillary Clinton got back down to D.C., all of a sudden, everybody changed his direction because she went down there and said to Clinton, you cannot sign this bill. And then she continues to tell the story here with Bill Moyers.
The proof is in the pudding. The last bill that came before President Clinton was that bankruptcy bill that was passed by the House and the Senate in 2000. And he vetoed it. And in her autobiography, Mrs. Clinton took credit for that veto, and she rightly should. She turned around a whole administration on the subject of bankruptcy. She
and
got
then,
it.
And then?
One of the first bills that came up after she was Senator Clinton was the bankruptcy bill. This is a bill that's like a vampire. It will not die, right? There's a lot of money behind it. And
the bill
just,
her husband had vetoed.
Her husband had vetoed it very much at her urging.
And?
She voted in favor of it.
Why?
As Senator Clinton, the pressures are very different. It's a well-financed industry. You know, a lot of people don't realize that the industry that gave the most money to Washington over the past few years was not the oil industry, was not pharmaceuticals, it was consumer credit products. Those are the people the credit card companies have been giving money, and they have influence.
And Mrs. Clinton was one of them, as senator.
Yeah. She has taken money from the groups, and more to the point, she worries about them as a constituency.
There you have it. And, you know, that is the example that you give. If you're Bernie Sanders. Now, I don't know why he doesn't know that, or he doesn't have that in there, or he's But that, you know, that's a missed opportunity. Now, there's going to be other debates, but, you know, as you get deeper into the campaign, it's tougher, frankly.
When you go to New York and you kind of are, you know, of elite status, which by the time they arrived in New York, you know, you're talking about an ex-president and first lady, you know, and they chose to move to New York, it was some of this stuff sort of becomes inevitable, right?
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that is the broader argument for Bernie to make. Now, as somebody
But it's not even when you go to New York. I mean, look, let's face it. Bill Clinton was surrounded by these bankers and would-be bankers and the Robert Rubens who were going to go and...
That's a good point.
And so,
then you become a...
But
you
you're drawing from the same
yeah.
well, right? Yeah, you move to New York. You ask these guys, like, where's the best place for me to live? I mean, it's that casual. And
right.
that these are just the waters that she's swimming in. And so right. that needs to be the argument by Bernie Sanders. We didn't hear that. I just think that the argument about her personal integrity misses the point entirely. And
I agree.
And because, you know, look, you know, politicians are politicians. The point is that I would have no problem if she got paid $50,000 from a union and then said, we've got to revamp Taft-Hartley. Frankly, I'd be very excited about that. If she went,
that's,
you know, after
I mean,
one talk,
right.
she gives
no
in front of the
AFL-CIO,
that'd
what
be
she
great.
Stands for or doesn't stand
right.
for. You know what I mean? And I mean, look, let me point in an equivalent direction where I think she's failing with Bernie, to be quite frank. You know, she's been attacking Bernie to a certain degree on the gun issue, right? And I've talked about this on the show.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter, you know, so he's, you know, like he's doing the bidding of the NRA or something like that, which clearly is not the case with him. I mean, he had a D-minus rating from them. He's not a well-rated, you know, not rated well by them. The thing about Bernie is he's from Vermont. And in his case, the well that he's swimming in much more is he's surrounded by a lot more rural progressives in a place like Vermont, where guns, because of you know, probably some of the best social benefits in the country, which makes a huge difference, and the fact that there aren't urban areas with as much of a disparity in income and these kinds of things. You know, you've got a lot of suicides in Vermont because of guns, which is another terrible scourge that they cause, but you don't have the kinds of things going on as you do in major urban areas. And because of that's the well, it just, you know, not the same, I wouldn't know if I put it exactly the same way, but that's who he's around. And I've been critical of him on this issue, very critical of him. But, you know, I always try to be fair and say, look, you know, there's a point where if you want to be president, you're surrounded by certain interests in your state and in your life. And, you know, you either find a way to transcend that or, you know, people are going to ask questions. And it doesn't mean that you don't have integrity. It means that there are certain, you know, certain people you've surrounded yourself by, you know, that you've surrounded yourself with. And you've done that for very specific reasons, because that's where you're from and that's what you do and that's your worldview. And I get it, you know, because Bernie hasn't had to deal with, you know, the crime situation, you know, in a number of cities. And that's, again, let's go with not the Republican line on that, which often involves racism. It's not that. It's income disparity. I mean, it's racism so that people have been victimized who are put in certain situations. But it's not like people wake up and are killing each other, you know, for that reason. It's the huge income disparities and the issues we have in our society that Bernie has not had to deal with as mayor of Burlington, quite frankly, or as a congressman or a senator. And these are so, I mean, I think in a way, Hillary's attacks on him are off the mark, too. Because she's, you know, and O'Malley did some of that, too. And some of the people who try to say, you know, you're just a shill for the NRA or whatever, you know, they even use that exact term. But it's not like Bernie's corrupt for the NRA and doing stuff for them. He just has represented and been around, surrounded by certain people with certain views. And, you know, now that's running into him, you know, in a similar way.
Yeah, so, it was interesting to me that she raised, I mean, you know, obviously the analogy breaks down because he doesn't have NRA advisors.
I'm not saying it's a perfect analogy.
Right, no, but I know what you're saying.
The world that they're from.
Yes,
you know?
Yes, yeah. That's true. And but I think, like, you know, she clearly is still sort of enmeshed in that more than he has. I mean, one is an elected, electoral constituency. Another is sort of a more of an elite. I mean, I don't know how many of those people there are in New York. You know, Wall Street people, but they're not a voting block enough to make a difference. They're a donor group
makes a difference. But I'm guessing even his friends and who he socializes with in Vermont, because of the way Vermont is, are gun owners.
I would be shocked if they weren't. And yes, he has sort of an awareness of that is different. That's true. That is true. The interesting thing to me, too, was that she brought up the gun issue almost right off the bat in this debate, which suggests to me, and to her credit, she's also going to Flint on Sunday, right? Which is not what you do if you think that New Hampshire is the whole ball game. She is using New Hampshire. I think she wants to close the gap in New Hampshire. Not lose. If she cannot lose by double digits, I think she's going to be very happy with that. But to talk about guns in that first opening salvo in New Hampshire suggests to me she's not really terribly concerned about winning New Hampshire, because, you know, it's Vermont.
South Carolina. It's Nevada. It's some of the some of the Super Tuesday states. Yep. And the fact that even Michigan itself is, as I remember, I don't remember the exact date, is relatively early in the process.
Yep.
And so you're exactly right. I mean, look, where her huge advantage is, and again, I've pointed this out before, and again, this is what I was talking about with Bernie, is that this has not been an issue in white rural areas. If anything, it's an issue where people don't want regulation. It's not on their minds. But, I've seen all this polling. This is what I do, a lot of what I do. And in terms of among Hispanic voters and among African Americans, concern about gun violence is so much higher by just, I can't even, I mean, statistically, it's just, 30, 40 points higher as a concern. So, there's a reason she's bringing that up off the bat, because that, to her, that's try part of the overall profile she's trying to build, appealing to those voters. And obviously, that's, Hispanic voters are going to play a very important part in Nevada, and African Americans are in South Carolina. I'm kind of interested to see what Bernie does with that, because if I'm his advisors, and I assume they know this stuff better than I do, Nevada's a caucus, and he's more likely to do better there, even with, with his more Hispanic voters there, and so I would think that he'd almost try to do in South Carolina what she's doing in New Hampshire, which is don't lose by too much. But if I were them, I'd be putting the effort into Nevada. But,
right. Yeah, I agree. I think that's what they're going to do too. Plus, it's a caucus in Nevada, and they, I think there's every reason to believe that they're going to sort of overperform in caucuses. And then let's just touch on this foreign policy thing, because I think, it is, she looks so much more fluent in foreign policy than he does, it is, and one can imagine when she gets up against one of the Republicans on foreign policy, because the interesting thing is, I mean, there was an interesting piece by Max Fisher in Vox, basically saying, look, Bernie Sanders has made a strategic decision to ignore foreign policy, like literally ignore it. Like he doesn't, people don't even know if he has foreign policy advisors, because the speculation is that he's making a calculation that the Democratic primary goers don't care that much about foreign policy, that it's better for him to expend more of his energy and his message on domestic issues, and that would theoretically ramp it up for a general election. And Fisher makes the point that, like, look, for the most part, when you're talking foreign policy, you take more or less your party's standard foreign policy line. You hire advisors who signify to the party establishment and elite more or less where you're going within those narrow parameters. And the argument is from Fisher that Bernie Sanders is not trying to appeal to the establishment anyways. And so why should he bother try and show his bona fides there? Now, he may or may not be right about the about whether or not the primary voters care. I mean, certainly, it seems to me that people notice that Bernie Sanders doesn't seem to have any, has not spent any real time thinking about foreign policy. With all that said, I don't know why we need to hear this. I mean, this to me is indicative of how the Clinton campaign always, not always, often doesn't really, isn't able to calibrate. I mean, it was so clear that she has a better command, not even a better command.
Yeah.
You know, of foreign policy. Now,
I may, just fluency.
Yeah, and yeah. I may not agree with any of her foreign policy positions, frankly. But
right.
She clearly has them. And in that arena, for a lot of people, it's just like, just make me feel confident that you have a grasp on the situation. And then she says that she's endorsed by this guy. And it's like, what?
Is there a department of government that you would get rid of? Or is there a whole new one that you would create?
The answer to both of those is no. I'm interested in making what we have work better. I want to streamline programs that are duplicative and redundant. I want to have a top-to-bottom review about what works and what doesn't work and be absolutely clear we're getting rid of what doesn't work. I have had the opportunity to run a big agency. I was very flattered when Henry Kissinger said I ran the State Department better than anybody had run it in a long time.
I mean, do we really
during a Democratic primary, especially if you're trying to, let's say, appeal to Asian voters, that doesn't seem like the best thing to bring up.
It just doesn't seem like, I mean, honestly, like, do you really need to cite, you know, I mean, I get it within the broader spectrum.
That's another thing, you know, that if Bernie were building this broader narrative, mind you, and, you know, you pointed out before, right, the former, her former top State Department person who's now at Kissinger's consulting firm. He could build that. She just mentioned Kissinger. You got that. If he were building that broader narrative about who she surrounds herself with, he could be like, do you think we should have a Democratic president who surrounds herself with or puts herself in Henry Kissinger's orbit, the guy that illegally bombed Cambodia? I mean, he could say a lot of stuff.
You know what he could have said? He could have just looked over and said, Henry Kissinger? Really? And that's it. That's all he had to say in that situation.
True.
And then everybody would give this knowing laugh, like, "Oh, I guess we can't really say that he's a war criminal in the middle of a debate." But I think we all know what he's talking about.
Right. So, I mean, that's exactly right. I think that.
Like, why do you need to do that? Like,
I don't
where
know.
Is your sense of who you're talking to? Like, what?
She's already running for the general election.
Yeah,
trying to sound bipartisan, and that, you know, you still have to defeat this guy.
Yeah, so, I'm bipartisan. I can reach across the aisle to all the war criminals.
I'm friends with Rumsfeld and Gina. Yeah, I mean, that doesn't seem like you're what I would call a smart move.
No.
I don't know. I don't know why she did that, except for what I just said. Or, you know, something that I wouldn't expect, which is maybe insecurity and trying to show that you're... But, I mean, why would she even need to do that? You ran the State Department. Done.
Right, exactly.
I don't get it. I would just say about Bernie, I agree with you, right? I mean, I guess as they're looking at it, it's not nearly as high an issue for Democrats on high on their list. There may be some certain groups that care about, you know, about certain areas of the world. There's obviously Jewish voters and others who may care about what's going on in Israel, and even that's a thorny patch to jump into. So you want to be careful. But I think if I were an advisor to Bernie Sanders, I would, you know, my view would be like, no, you don't give any speeches on it. You don't go out of your way to talk about it. But I do think you need to have a bit more fluency.
Yes.
Because I know he's a senator, and I know the veteran stuff he's done, and so I know he knows enough to be commander-in-chief. But I'm me, and you're you, and we pay attention to this stuff for a living. So for people watching who don't, the fact that he's kind of really having to choose his words and isn't really fluent in what he's saying and says some kind of strange stuff about North Korea, I would practice it more, quite frankly, and become more fluent in sort of being able, I mean, have your policies for the 8 trouble zones or whatever they are. You know, have a sort of coherent vision and say, here's the way I see this, and have it all be in a narrative and just, you know, be able to flip it out whenever somebody asks.
And you know what I would do, and I say this as someone who, you know, I supported at the very least the air campaign in Libya, and I think, you know, have come to realize that even when there's a limited mandate, there that's generally a fig leaf. But the intervention, the overthrow of Gaddafi has proved to be, as far as I can tell, fairly disastrous. And so every time he brings up the Iraq war, he should add, and Libya, because then, you know, there's no time for him to even have to express a foreign policy, because then it's back on Clinton to have to respond to make it a judgment. Make it a right. judgment issue. You know, yes.
Remember the attack on Bush over Iraq was, not, this is a disastrous war. It wasn't handled competently. We were lied into it. You know, we've pointed out many things. To me, you know, in a way, Libya was the good Iraq war. It was the Iraq war if Bush had actually handled it competently, if they knew what they should know going in. You know, if they limited what we did there, so we were in and we were out, and to me, still a massive failure. Libya, right. I thought was a bad idea from the beginning, and, you know, because I thought we'd all learn from the Iraq war. Yes, you can handle it better. You could do it more competently. You cannot waste as much money. You can protect more lives on the ground. You can protect the lives of your soldiers. You can do a whole lot of stuff. But in the end, what matters, you know, in the long term is the vacuum you leave there. And who steps into that vacuum? And unless there is, you know, a lot of different things going on there, you know, some sort of tradition in terms of democratic representation that's been suppressed that can be brought back out, you know, people that are yearning for democracy who want it themselves. I mean, unless these things are going on, then when there is a vacuum in power, is that the person with the most convincing story, which usually is a demagogue, or the most weapons, or both, is the one who takes over.
Right.
I mean, that's just what happens in these places. So, I mean, again, you know, that was why I've been against going into Syria, too. You know, I mean, give me a place where I can go into, and it's clear lines. You've got a civilian population, and you've got soldiers murdering them, and I think we should go in to protect that civilian population, like a Rwanda. All right? That is the only circumstance under which my
personal belief is we should
be getting involved.
At the beginning of Libya, it was...
Obviously, barring an
attack. It was about Benghazi. You know. It was about the idea that Gaddafi had promised to essentially annihilate 250,000 people. And that is ostensibly what the UN resolution and authorization was about. But it went further to regime change.
Then you go and protect those people, and you do what you can. And look, I would save every last person, because I hate looking at people as numbers. I'm a number, and you're a number, and our families, I assume, would care if we were gone. So I can't stand when you do calculations that way. I would go in and say, try to do what we could to protect every last person. But these things are complicated. This is not easy stuff. It's not always black and white. It usually
isn't. And you don't always have a solution.
And you just can't always do anything to help. And it's terrible. It is terrible. I mean, I that's one of the things I hate most in this world, is that we have to sometimes accept that there's nothing we can do.
Right.
And, you know, if we could have protected those people, I don't know the whole situation well enough. I wasn't in secretive briefings on it. If there was a way to get in there with a multinational force, protect people, and not go on an offensive war, I'd be all for it. But forget about taking the guy out. That was not what we should have done. And, you know, and taking all of his military out. Because in the end, that's the vacuum. It's sort of like George H.W. Bush handled, you know, that war as well as it could have been handled. I still don't think we should have been involved in it and should have been there. But, you know, at least it was handled well. But, you know, and I'll give them credit. At least afterwards, they left the guy in power.
Right.
Yes, he was a terrible guy. But does anybody want to argue now what was worse, the situation with Saddam Hussein in power or the situation since without him in power? He wasn't publicly executing people. You know, I mean, I'm not saying he was a good guy. Don't get me wrong. But, I mean, you know, sometimes there's no good answer.
The pictures of you with Saddam at Studio 54 are safe.
Well, we were partying there. That was in my breakdancing phase. You're right. And
I still.
And then there was that time when I went with McCain and him, and I tweeted out what a great guy he was. Oh wait, that was just John McCain. I'm sorry.
We should say that you know, I think that Bernie Sanders. It seems to me it could have been a very effective line. As soon as Clinton said Kissinger, he could have just said. Something to the effect of like, yeah, Henry Kissinger, also very experienced, you know. I mean that to me is, you know, that's the point. And I don't know, he could get a little sharp.
And I'll just say, you know, as a last thing, I talked about the broader narrative on on the economic world, but the truth of the matter is Henry Kissinger gives you then the window into combining that narrative with the foreign policy world, too.
Right.
He's a twofer, if you will.
Yes, that's true. Cliffy, as always, a pleasure. We'll have plenty to talk about next week and the week after that. Although I think the week after that, actually, we're going to be we may be back on that Friday. I'm not sure. We're still working that out. But in the meantime,
What's going on? Is there vacation time coming up?
There is a mid-February break, and it's
that's right.
I've got to. I'm on daddy
what the heck
duty
to do with the kids, kind of thing.
Yeah,
I've got that too. So we'll have to figure that all out. Okay.
All right, folks. Cliff, as always, real pleasure. Thanks so much, bud.
Thanks a lot, man.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye bye. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, what will you be doing Sunday at 6:30 p.m.? Will you be watching the superb owl? Or will you be looking to watch something else? Well, if you're looking to watch something else, we're going to have somebody on in a moment to tell you what you should be watching. We'll take a quick break when we come back. Matthew Film Guy will be joining us. We'll be right back after this. Back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, Super Bowl Sunday. Do you watch the Super Bowl or do you watch something else? Well, our next guest will tell us what that something else might be, but only after we hear his intro song. Matthew.
Hey, not done yet.
Matthew Film Guy, the...
Okay, now it's done.
The guest who commissioned his own theme song, ladies and gentlemen. That's the way you do it, folks. And
right.
I should say that Matthew... I texted you that you were running 10 minutes late, and you have been infected... I don't know if you've been infected by Trump or by Michael doing Trump. You're pathetic. You're a loser. It's true. It's true. Like 90% of the texts now I get are like that. It's all just sort of like, it's true. It's true. It's always the...
I mean, I really thought it was very pathetic the way you handled it. I mean, Cliff's interview, it's a mess.
All of the IMs I get from Michael now, too. It's all like Cliff saying he's a fantastic guy, great guy. It's like he's not, there's nothing, it's just like a, it's like a, it's like I'm like floating in like one of those sort of oxygen, sensory deprivation tanks. And the only thing I'm floating in is all this sort of Trump speak.
Sam, get on board. Image. It's intoxicating. It's really a fantastic way to talk. It's true.
Now, Matthew, let me ask you this. Did you watch the debate last night?
I did. I watched, I'd say I tuned in live about three quarters of the way in, and then I went back and watched some of the highlights. So I was there for most of it.
Now, let me ask you this, because as I was listening to your theme song, it reminded me of something about the debate.
Really?
Was the debate not last night? Was it not, didn't it have a quality that like, it looked like it was shot by Cassavetes?
They had some very uncomfortably close close-ups of both of the candidates at all times, even the split screens. You're right. It was like 30% too tight on their faces, I think, for a kind of respectable distance. It was. They were trying to get you into their emotional space.
But it also, it wasn't just that it was, I mean, it was 30% too tight on the close-ups, but also the angle, it was sort of slightly above eye line. So it was sort of like this, like literally like there was like a drone hovering like just above their heads shooting them. It was very strange. And it was all handheld, or they either got so tight that that the camera was shaking. It was very disconcerting.
I have a feeling it was on some sort of boom or jib there, but it was, you're right. It was kind of floating, kind of kinetic. And it definitely made you feel like you were like sitting on their faces while you were listening to them talk. And neither of them necessarily have the smoothest face to sit on.
I kept waiting for one of them to say, like, please, can I have some personal space? Like, you're getting too much into my space.
Just about 10 feet, please.
No eye contact.
Well, that's the thing is, there wasn't eye contact because the camera was like...
No peripheral eye contact.
It was weird.
Well, they were looking down on them. They were sort of like, they were like specimens in like a Petri dish kind of a feeling.
Yep, I found that very problematic.
You know, I think Bernie also does have to work on his, like, intra-questioning facial responses, you know what I'm saying? Like he's biting his lip and he's kind of grimacing. I think he could, work on his on-camera sort of, resting face a little bit better.
Yeah.
I don't think the close angle did him any favors there, but he still got my vote, Sam, you know that.
I do?
Yep, he's got my, no. Bernie does.
Oh,
Bernie
yes. Does. Okay.
No, you got my vote, too. If you would run for something, I'd vote for you, obviously.
I'll keep that in mind.
I'll stuff the ballot box just like I do every year for the podcast awards.
That's what I'd like to hear that, actually. Yeah. Actually, that reminds me. When are those nominations? We got to look that up. So, Matthew, what is new with you? I know that, sometimes you're directing a web series or other times you're...
Yeah, actually, I'm doing some work with Ted Alexandro right now. We're archiving his 20 years in comedy. You know, I don't know if you've ever had this experience with some of the comedians you've worked with, but they tend to accumulate videos and documents of all of their stand-up. I mean, he's been in stand-up for 20 years, so I've been spending time archiving, like, all of his sets. Like, the club will give you a tape, you know, of, like, every night for a week or something like that.
Ah.
So I've been diving deep into that. And,
now, what is he using that for? Because I have, like, a bunch of... I mean, I have so many... I've started to do with some of my audio stuff. Like, I found that those conversations I had with those Nigerian 419 guys, and then I found other... I found my first radio show in college, which was horribly embarrassing, my bar mitzvah tape. Audio tape, I actually...
Yeah, the world has got to hear those, Sam. You've got to digitize those and upload those so the world...
That's a different level of membership. But what do you do with 20 years of stand-up?
Well, you know, he's going to have it as an archive, and eventually when...
he gets
when dollars want to look back and make a box set of every little piece of minutia that Ted Alexandro ever was involved with, they will have it at their fingertips. I just think it's a good thing to have.
Is he paying you for this?
On a personal level.
I mean, I got to imagine, a little bit, the
friend rate, you know.
Oh, all right.
But it's definitely a labor of love. I'm listening to the same sets like, you know, 30, 40 times a day. It's actually very interesting insight into what it takes to be a professional comedian for so long, like Ted's been.
I wonder, I mean, can you come up with something out of it? I mean, do you make some type of, I don't know, mini documentary about the development of a specific joke? I mean, it's sort of like the Aristocrats or something like that, right?
That actually is a potential possibility from this, just to see the evolution of a joke, the evolution of a performance, you know, how you find stuff going on through the time. So
I know how you think, Matthew Film Guy.
Yeah. Not everything I do is necessarily for my own personal use, but yeah, you know, you're onto something there, Sam. I think your idea is fantastic. It's great.
Jesus.
And I want to say, Sam, you know, I'm always here for you to do these segments, even if you call me late on the same day. You know I'm going to be there. I understand that, you know, it's 2 a.m., you're at the bar, you've got to have somebody do the movie segment. And so you pick someone and you go with them, you know, I appreciate that.
I don't know if everybody, the non-members did not hear the Ernie Bach Jr. defense of why he's voting for Donald Trump, as if like everybody's been, you know, buzzing about how is Ernie Bach Jr. going to justify this? It's like, but
you had Isabel last week, and then you had Andy Kindler, and the last time I was on with only Michael. So sure,
there you go.
I'm here.
And you're still, obviously, you've got your annex, your is it the Jewish old age home annex class that you teach?
Yeah, the JCC classes. I'm doing that. I'm also, you know, teaching editing at the graduate school at in Stanford at Sacred Heart University. That started back up again.
Whoa, so that's not child's play. That's not, I mean, that's serious business, isn't it, or no?
That's right. That's serious business. This is my third year doing it, so I've got a pretty tight curriculum going now, and I recommend it highly to anybody thinking of going to film school in the tri-state area.
Do you have a coupon code? A majority?
Use the coupon code Matthew Film Guy and get 0% off, unfortunately. There's no coupon code.
You know, that's the thing what you got to do, Matthew, is you got to start selling a product so you can come on here and pitch it.
I know. Well, my eBay link is now on my Twitter page, so if anyone wants to go there, feel free.
Are you selling any Majority Report paraphernalia?
No, I've reached the bottom of the barrel. Although I think I have two mouse pads and a hat left, but I think I'm going to keep those.
Well, I don't blame you. You know, you should come by this office because we've got a lot of stuff here. We've got a lot of stuff here that you could come by with the big box. And
okay,
you know, I would even do like some type of, I don't know, very
90-10 media.
I don't know if I go 90-10, but I think we could get, yeah, you know, in a neighborhood that you would appreciate, because right, I got the stuff sitting in here. I got to move it.
Look, I support the show in many ways. You know, I always buy Just Coffee, although I have a little bone to pick about Just Coffee, if you give me a second here.
Sure.
Now I love Just Coffee, and I spend hundreds of dollars a year on them. And I have just now finally realized, after buying the 5-pound bag, get ready with the Perry Mason sound here. After buying the 5-pound bag, I realized it's actually more expensive than buying 5 individual pound bags.
You're kidding. That doesn't make any sense.
I am not kidding.
But wait, they don't sell those bags. Are not pound bags.
Those little bags are not 1 pound?
No, they don't sell one. Nobody sells 1 pound coffee bags. They're like 12-ounce bags. Will you go grab me that the small one? The small bag.
Well, we're going to do the investigation. That makes the goddamn difference, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Taking a look here at the Majority Report blend. Net weight, 12 ounces. The small bags are 12 ounces, buddy. A pound is 16 ounces. Am I mistaken with that?
Just Coffee's off the hook.
Wow. How long have you been carrying this around?
About 2 weeks.
See that? See that? This is. I have sensed a spinoff, a show.
Mystery solved. Brought up, resolved, solved.
I sense
Sam Cedar, detective.
Kelly, what do you think? Maybe a spinoff show where we
will you be a detective?
No, we just convert ounces to pounds. Call in.
Just call. Please make a blend called 16 ounces in a pound so I can remember every time.
How much pound or not pound? Then maybe that would we call it. That would be the name of the podcast.
How about this skills? Week, is it a pound?
There you go.
It is not a pound. Well, I still thought it was low class and pathetic of
But it turned out that you were the sad one. That you couldn't
listen. It was rigged. It was rigged. The website used to say 16 ounces. Now suddenly they changed everything.
Listen. Do we have?
I still want Sam. I want you to have a detective podcast. Please.
All right, I'll work on it. Okay. I'm ready to do this. Do we have the clip of me from yesterday? Where I said that thing about the end of the clap thing, where I said that thing about Barbara Bush. Can you grab that? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Did we clip it for YouTube?
No, did we clip it? I think we did clip that for YouTube, didn't we, or no? When I was saying, like, yes. The clap thing that... all right, so, Matthew, let's play this clip with you. We don't generally do this, but...
please.
You have been in as much therapy as almost anybody I know.
Thank you.
And you spent a lot of time sort of... you know, looking into therapy too. So you're as knowledgeable about therapy as anybody I know who's not an actual therapist. Because of course I know many therapists, and of course I have friends who have been in extensive therapy.
I mean, they're really total losers.
But listen. I want you to now on the program. Do you have this sound, Matt?
I just have Jeb from.
Okay. All right. Well, the other day we played a clip of Jeb Bush asking people to clap for him after, and it's a fairly well-known clip at this point.
Yeah.
And after that, it occurred to me that there was a quality to that clip, a school marmishness that led me to believe, because we've been speculating because of the way that Donald Trump has been abusing Jeb and the way that he's been taking it and almost sort of like desperately needing it in some way. Like this was a pattern in his life and he felt more comfortable taking this abuse than having it not there in some way, which is, as you know, is often the case with a lot of people. That's why you continually, you know, get into dysfunctional relationships. Not you, but one,
that's right.
Perhaps.
No, even me. You know, you'd rather be unhappy in a way that is familiar than happy in a new and different way.
Right, and it's not
you
even
took the words out of my mouth.
It's not even a question of would rather. It's that it's just more sort of subconsciously comfortable for you.
Yeah, you're more comfortable there. You seek it out. Absolutely. That's what,
and
that's
Jeb gave this sort of what he thought, I think, was a rousing sort of speech about, you know, being commander in chief. And people just sort of sat there and stared at him. And he just looked at him, please clap. And that moment, yeah. It occurred to me that Jeb had also been... had been, you know, sort of abused by his mom psychologically,
yeah.
Because there was a real sort of like quality of like, I'm disappointed in you, that you didn't even know to clap, which really struck me as something like that. It seemed like it come from his mom. Well, the next day, as Jeb Bush is unraveling, this is what he had to say on the campaign trail. Jeb Bush.
A joy to be with friends. To be with my mother, who I adore, who is an inspiration. I cannot tell you in the probably 90 versions of town hall meetings I've done all across this state how many times people came up and said, your mother, I love your mother. I love your mother. Just over and over again. She's not as great as everybody thinks she is. I can just tell you that one.
Whoa.
I jokingly say that when we were growing up in Midland in Houston, that mom was fortunate not to have a child abuse hotline available because the discipline of learning right and wrong was her doing.
Yes. What to make of this Matthew film guy who clearly, because you're a film guy, have the ability to psychoanalyze this piece?
That's part of the film guy resume, is also being able to psychologically analyze. But listen, have you ever read the works of Alice Miller, the German psychoanalyst who wrote on childhood development. She wrote The Drama of the Gifted Child.
Oh, okay.
So her whole theory is that children who are brought up in abusive relationships learn to adapt to service their parent in an emotional way because that's how they avoid the abuse. They become more sensitive. And she wrote a whole book that basically said these people either become artists and creative people to kind of find an outlet for these unmet needs, or they become dictators and strongmen and authoritarians. And she did a comparison between Buster Keaton and Picasso with Hitler and Stalin, and how they all had similar abusive childhoods. And it was actually their mothers in all of those cases, not necessarily their fathers, that drove them into this particular kind of mindset. Now, Jeb Bush is he's a milquetoast, he's a, you know, sad sack, he's all these things.
Low energy.
I am sure he has filtered that same exact sort of need for power to prove who he is from that kind of an upbringing. It makes perfect sense to me. And that is quite the sort of a subconscious dig at his mother. She's not as great as people say she is.
Well, it's not really subconscious.
No, it's not. That he could say it with no irony or even with irony. It's a cry for help.
Well, it's a cry for help because he can't help himself. Like, he's complimenting his mom, and then when they respond so well to that, he's like, whoa, wait a second. I can't. Yeah. I have to be true to myself. She's a horrible person. She tortured me.
Yeah, and you know, and it says a lot about how structures of authoritarian power get passed down on the large scale. You know, it all does start in the family, and you know, I know you, for years you and Janine had this conversation about whether or not people in these positions are basically just enacting psychological issues, or if they have some sort of objective, perspective on these things. But I tend to think in this case that's a pretty remarkable statement, revealing statement about what it was like inside the Bush family.
Well, Kelly disagrees with you. She's shaking her head.
Well, that's probably because she still identifies with her abuser, but that's fine.
I don't necessarily disagree with this one. I'm a
contrarian. He's a film guy, Kelly. You sure you want to?
Oh, no, that was an excellent answer, by the way. I don't necessarily disagree with this whole Jeb Bush narrative that's happening because I don't know. There's just no way for me to know.
And you can't necessarily psychoanalyze someone through a clip, but you know, it's fun.
Well, right,
to try.
No, but the series of clips that have been coming up recently, I am just not convinced that he is not just kidding on a lot of these things when he's saying, when he said, "Please clap." I mean, it looked really bad. But then the same day, later on, I watched a clip where he was walking around and one guy said that he had like swung his vote toward him and he got this like look on his face and he like ran up and hugged the kid. And like, it was funny. He was kidding. You know what I mean?
But what's just kidding, Kelly? What's the source of humor? There's always truth in a joke.
I think he knows
he's
going to lose.
Haven't you ever heard kidding on the square?
He's totally losing. So,
well, look,
and I don't think he cares that much necessarily.
Listen,
and he's just like,
I get the kidding. I get the kidding. I mean, but.
Yeah, sure. No, the kidding is our way in. Our kidding is the way that we can understand what's really going on with him.
I don't really know.
Well, you know what? Here's another joke.
Sure,
let me give you
an
alternate joke.
Maybe.
Let me give you an alternate joke in that Barbara Bush situation. Maybe she should run instead of me. Not. She's a horrible person for real.
I mean, that's not really a joke. She's not as good as you think she is.
It's just a stupid joke about how she is widely
revered. I hate my
mother.
I'm just kidding. I don't hate her.
Good material. My mother's a horrible bitch. I hate her.
No, and I hate your mother, too. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
But we've speculated.
My mom said that I asked for if I could call the police on her when I was little all the time for child abuse. I had somehow heard about it. It wasn't child abuse. She just wouldn't let me do whatever I wanted. It was just normal
stuff.
Well,
yes, that's different than you saying right now on this show, I legitimately could have called child abuse on my mom.
That would be a total joke if I said that. It would be ridiculous.
We have some thoughts about this.
I mean, I think it's quite clear that it's Barbara Bush is God knows what's been going on in that that house.
Jim, Jim, come give me a massage. I need to big
my onions
my
are
gosh,
acting up.
Jim.
My onions.
Jim.
Exactly.
George told me that's how George established his respect
hey, Mom,
with her.
Just go, Jeb's over there. I'm going to go out and party.
Hey, Mom, I got my old girlfriend now.
That's right.
I'm not going to rub your back
I'm
anymore.
Going out with Laura. Get Jeb to do it. He'll do anything for a quarter.
Your brother's
Wait,
not a pussy
is,
like you. I'm going to need another body rub.
I think George is older.
George is, okay, sure. It makes perfect sense. You know, he's the mama's boy. He's the one that had to always stay home with Mom while George was out partying. That's
Mom, can we not play strip poker again tonight?
Don't be such a girl, Jeb. Just do it.
Stop pretending just like you it. Haven't seen your mother before.
Mom,
I've seen you naked plenty of times. I changed your diapers.
I created you.
Exactly.
Now put the cards on the table, you little pussy. Mom just always really has it for you, doesn't she? Anyway, I'm gonna go out
and you
do
know
some
what
blow.
Else? You know what else you're not factoring in here is where's Dad? Dad's never home. Dad's always
he's
at the
CIA. Greatest man alive.
He was such a good man.
It's really
he was
it's
such
it's,
a good man.
It's unbelievable. Wait, do we have that? And it is. I mean, that's the dynamic, right? Dad goes off to Washington for Congress, and he's at home with Mom. Like when the door opens and Dad comes home, he's like, "Oh, thank God."
Turning right and wrong was her doing. My dad was this perfect, idyllic man who, to this day, is the greatest man alive.
He was the man who interrupted the strip poker games and the full body rubdowns that mother forced me to do.
He would come home and then
he would say, "No, you can't force him to put Ben Gay on your back and your thighs anymore. He's the greatest man alive." He was especially.
Oh no!
My dad was this perfect, idyllic man who, to this day, is the greatest man alive.
Okay. Like okay. Superman, he would come in, he would save me from the.
he would come home, and Mom
emotion,
would be saying that I wouldn't get dinner if I didn't let her give me a lap dance. And he would say, "No, that boy's getting dinner. And it's okay that he forgot to bring his tennis racket in." And
oh.
He just could not see, imagine a more loving human being.
No. All right, Matthew Film Guy, give us your expert opinion as someone who works with video.
I think the two of you guys could benefit from some group therapy. You and Michael and Kelly and Matt should sit around, and I think you could work a lot of this stuff out.
Michael has just literally like just been has been IMing me like, please can we do this? Please can we,
please
can I go?
Please,
can I go?
Can, do
can
it?
I
can
go?
I
go
now? Can we did this in the office.
A horrible
morning.
Scenario. With, oh,
can
geez.
We do a throw Mom off the train scenario? Is there anybody else want your wives killed? And I could Ben, I could kill your wife, and you could kill my mom. We could turn this into a whole other deal. That would be great.
All right, so Matthew, what did you were about to say the choking up part?
Well, just to me, that catch in his throat, it can mean anything. It's not to me. It's not necessarily.
No, he's sad because his dad is. I think his dad
emotion.
Is very. I think his dad is you know is in poor health and is probably. I think he feels like his dad is not. You know, his dad went into the hospital recently, and I think he's.
Yeah.
Really sort of dealing with the you know, sort of the on the eve of the loss of his father. You know, I mean, so I don't want to be too cruel here, but, you know, I mean...
That's the first.
Who's gonna save me from Mom when you're gone?
Well, yeah, I kind of think that...
Jeff, come here!
That's in there.
All right. Well, Matthew, let's move on to the real reason why you're here. It's been
all right.
It's been 30 minutes.
Michael, are you good?
Michael's all right. He's been satiated. It's the only thing that got him off of Trump for about 10 minutes. So I had to let him.
It was
do
a fantastic routine. It's true. It's true.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean,
Matthew Film Guy. It's Super Bowl.
Still here.
Counter programming. What do we got?
All right. Well, you know, the Super Bowl is a time for people to coalesce around a sort of fake feeling of you know, tribal identification and sort of a, you know, you might say a vicarious thrill of violence. So as a perfect counterpoint to this regular sort of displacement of these feelings, I wanted to recommend a movie that actually takes that kind of feeling as its purpose, as its topic. I don't know if you've ever seen this film, Sam, by the late, great British director Alan Clark. It's called The Firm. I may have mentioned it before, but it's with Gary Oldman in an early role in the late, it's the late 80s. And he plays a now middle-class father with a sort of middle-class life, but yet he still yearns for and participates in the sort of soccer hooliganism of his youth. And in England, they have what they call the firms, and it's these basically gangs who use the games as just basically an excuse to go beat the shit out of each other. And you almost see none of the actual soccer games in this movie. It's just about the sort of organized tribal gang violence that he just cannot wrest himself away from. He's sort of struggling with trying to establish himself in this new sort of respectable middle-class life, and yet back in his childhood home, he still keeps those sort of like brickbats and maces and chains that he uses to go out on the weekends and just get into these horrible, violent fights. So I think it's a good movie to sort of really... It's for us to ask ourselves, what is it we get out of identifying with sports teams? I'm a huge basketball fan, but I don't take it to the point where, like, if the team loses the championship, I'm miserable for the rest of the year. I feel like if you, you know, have fun, identify with the team, enjoy that sort of cheap high. I'm not against that at all. But if you are beating your kids or you're carrying it more than after one night's sleep, I think you need to examine that.
That's
so this is a movie that basically puts that under the microscope. And, it's disturbing, it's questioning, it's not a kind of, it's not just a sort of an issue film. It really implicates the audience. As you're sort of getting into it, it shocks you out of it. There are some amazing reversals. I won't give it away, but I highly recommend it. It is streaming on Amazon Prime.
So basically a date movie.
Yes, yeah, it's a date movie. I think a perfect movie for you and Nikki, actually.
Okay. Matthew Film Guy with The Firm. I love it. I love the, you're going to expose exactly what's going on when we watch football. The subtextual, feelings, Matthew Film Guy, always a pleasure, buddy. Thank you so much.
Same here, Sam.
All right. Folks, that is our free portion of the program today. We're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half, wherein we will take your phone calls and your IMs. We will also, do we have any, well, we may have to play the Jeb sound again. I know, it's wrong. It's wrong to pick on him this way, but.
Jeb, you're going to lose.
Guess what? Popular sentiment changes.
All right, folks. We'll see you on Monday. Michael will have an interview with who are you interviewing on Monday?
Ronnie Cusrells. He's the former Minister of Intelligence in South Africa and a veteran ANC guerrilla fighter.
And I will be calling in from New Hampshire if all things go well. And we'll be right back with the fun half in just a moment.
Sit in a blue pen.